What do you think causes depression? If I were to go out and just ask any random person on the side of the street this question, 85% of them are going to say that it's the result of a chemical imbalance in their brain. I mean, it's incredible how pervasive this narrative is. And it's been the foundation of psychiatry for over 30 years. Right now, just in America, one out of every seven people is on an antidepressant medication. One out of every seven. And most of those people were probably told at some point by their prescriber that there was something wrong with their brain, that this pill that they were taking was supplementing their brain. It was giving them something that their brain was lacking. It was restoring that chemical imbalance. But where did this chemical imbalance theory even come from? And is there really a lot of scientific support for the idea that depression is the result of low serotonin in the brain? Now, don't get us wrong. This conversation is not an indictment on antidepressants. We absolutely recognize the tremendous relief that these medications have brought to millions of people around the world, the reduction in suicide rates. What we want to do, though, is to broaden the perspective a little bit and look at whether or not this story of broken brains that need chemical fixes is the right approach, and whether or not a narrative like that has the potential to possibly do more harm than good in some cases.
Welcome to The Social Brain. I'm Andrew.
And I'm Taylor. And this is a show where we dive into how the brain works. If you've ever wondered what's going on inside your mind, even the things that you're not even aware of, then this is the place where we can unpack that and really explore it.
Yeah, so getting into this a little bit more, a lot of this episode, we'll be talking about the serotonin hypothesis of depression. We'll also get into a little bit of the history of these medications, where this idea came from. And we're going to talk about what serotonin does in the brain, what it really does. I don't want to give too much away already. So I think we're going to dive right into the history of like psychopharmacology in general. And take it away, Taylor.
Yeah. So I want to really make things clear right here at the outset that we're talking about medication today. Andrew and I are not psychiatrists. We're not clinical doctors, right? We're researchers that look at kind of the available data, what the science is saying about all of this stuff. So if you have any questions that arise because of this, because there's going to be some pretty sensitive stuff that we're talking about that might be kind of shocking to some people, make sure that you're talking to a physician about these things. If you're thinking about coming off of a medication, whatever it may be, do that in a way that is safe, that is with any kind of provider that you have. What we want to do first is really kind of dive into the history of psychiatric medication, because the history is fascinating. Like, most of these medications were discovered by accident. And a lot of these ideas that people have about the chemical imbalance in their head was actually just the result of an accidental medicine doing something. And then us saying, oh, well, if it does that, then that means that there's probably an imbalance, right? So one thing that I really want to highlight right at the beginning is that psychiatric meds are only like 100 years old. And if we're talking antidepressants, that's like late 80s, early 90s, right? These things are very new in terms of us not really knowing about long-term effects of these things, what they're doing to the brain after years and years and years of taking them, whatever it may be. But one of the things that's really interesting to think about is that 150 years ago, the beginning of the 1900s, we didn't even know that microbes, that like bacteria, was causing disease in the body. Like, that was like a crazy idea.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And I mean, like, the drug discovery in general, like pharmacology, is not very old science. Like, We only have had antibiotics for about 100 years, and they've only been really widely available for I think about 80 years. So that's something to keep in mind. You could look and say we've had vaccines for a lot longer than that, but regardless, like, just in general, our understanding of how drugs affect the body, how they affect the brain, the cells of the body, all these things, it is really new. And then if you just think about how complicated the science of understanding how drugs affect the body, drugs that are meant to, whatever it may be, like antibiotics, how they actually work and what they're doing and all the side effects. And then you turn to the brain, right? I remember this researcher, I can't remember his name, but he was a guy who's involved in researching drugs for the central nervous system. And he said, there are pharmacologists who study, or who drug discovery scientists who study, who try to develop drugs. And then there are central nervous system drug discovery scientists. And his point there was to just highlight that, like, the brain and the central nervous system is this immensely complex system that makes this whole process of trying to understand the side effects and what exactly is going on so much harder. That's just something I think is really important to put as kind of a background for the conversation. And it kind of helps to explain some of the misconstruals of, you know, when we're talking about depression, the chemical imbalance and serotonin and all these things, and why there has been a lot of misconceptions about these things, and why we're starting to discover new stuff about them, because the brain is so complex. Our studying of the brain is so new. Studying of drugs in general is pretty new. So anyway, that's just like a kind of background. I think that's important.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Because I think something that's really important that Andrew's kind of getting at is when you look at the history of where these drugs came from, right? Early 1900s, we were just discovering that, like, cells had receptors on them. There's this guy, Paul Ehrlich, that was like testing dyes and found out that the dyes only affected certain cells. And then they were like, oh, wow, we can, like, actually target specific things in the body. And that was just this new idea. And it actually created this, like, this gold rush for trying to find what they called magic bullets, where it was like, wow, we now know that bacteria is causing infectious disease. So we're just going to try all of these molecules to try to kill bacteria without killing the host. I think this guy, Paul Ehrlich, they tested, I think, like 910 different compounds, and his assistant went back and tried 606 on a different bacteria, and it ended up killing syphilis without killing the rabbit. And that was the first time that we had discovered, and like the highlights were like, this is biblical what this is doing, right? And it started this revolution in medicine, where now there was just this huge, like I said, gold rush in trying to find compounds that were specifically targeting diseases, right? And one of the things that's really important, the reason I'm highlighting like why this started with antibiotics and destroying bacteria and viruses and all of that kind of stuff, is because that's how we discovered psychiatric medication. Because we were actually testing different chemicals to kill certain types of bacteria, and accidentally found out that those compounds that we were using were producing cognitive effects. Like the first one that was ever discovered was Thorazine. And it was this thing that they discovered in these rats that they were working with, that it just completely like made them just non-emotive. They were not moving anything. It was like they had gone through what they would a lobotomy, but from a drug. And that like revolutionized psychiatry, because now you had these psych wards. Like the main treatment in psychiatry was like spraying people with water, electroconvulsive therapy, giving people like metrazole poison that was causing these like insulin like seizures that people were going through. Like that was like the main psychiatric treatment at the time. And now they had these pills that were making people really docile and really calm. And then the same thing happened with anxiolytics. Like the first anxiety drugs was someone testing stuff on antibiotics and found that the rat was laying on its back and was not like in an anxious state, because when rats lay on their back, they get really nervous. But this rat was laying on his back and its heart was beating just fine. And all of a sudden there's this revolution of anxiety drugs, and they're just like widely prescribed, mostly to like single housewives, or not single housewives, like house moms. Like, it's really interesting. And that's something that we really want to put in perspective at the beginning, at the outset, is that a lot of this stuff was discovered by accident. And then because we discovered it and we started to see like, oh, these drugs have these effects, then the digging started to happen of like, okay, now why are they having an effect? And that's really where the story kind of goes from there.
Yeah, definitely. I guess one thing to keep in mind, like we're not saying that drugs were only discovered 100 years ago. Like people have known that that certain substances are psychoactive, that they'll change your psychology, how you feel, all these things for a very long time. I mean, we've You know, that a lot of interestingly, like, you know, when we're talking about, like in our last episode, we talked about psychedelics, you know, a lot of the reason that we know about psychedelics is because there are these like ancient or are these chemicals that have been used by ancient societies. And we've known we've had alcohol and THC and caffeine and cocaine, all these like different things that affect the mind and change people's behavior and how they feel and all that. So I just want to get that out there. Like, we're not so naive to be saying that the drugs were discovered 100 years ago.
And but it's something that's
the scientific study process of developing drugs is what we're talking about, really.
And that's it's a really good point, because up until the discovery of Thorazine, the main anesthetic that was used in surgery was morphine. And morphine was really dangerous because it could slow down the heart and it could slow down the lungs and it could kill people at high doses. And Thorazine seemed to be this thing that just kind of disconnected the mind from the body. And it was something that was like a new way of like interacting with these anesthetics that hadn't existed before, which is a really good point that Andrew's making, is that like a lot of these kind of found in nature type drugs have been used for millennia, but these are the first ones that we're manufacturing. We're testing all of these specific compounds for specific cognitive effects and then manufacturing them and turning them into a product, which I think is really big, kind of setting up the narrative that comes next. Because what we really want to get into today is the idea of depression, right? Where did this chemical imbalance idea in depression actually come from? And the first medications for depression were discovered by accident as well. They were actually testing leftover like jet fuel from World War II to see if those compounds had any effect on reducing tuberculosis. And there was this drug called iproniazid that was used to treat TB, tuberculosis. And they noticed that in these TB wards that they were treating, that the patients were like very energized. Like they were like dancing in the halls. And it seemed to be that this drug that was really effective at treating tuberculosis was also what they called a psychic energizer. And that became the kind of first line of, and it was an MAO inhibitor, which was the first type of antidepressants. Around the same time, tricyclics also made an appearance that was discovered by accident as well. They were testing compounds for schizophrenia, and they found that tricyclics had this antidepressant effect. And what all of this kind of leads to is that we kind of came by chance to these drugs that seemed to be reducing these depressive symptoms in people. And then after we found that they worked, then we were trying to see, okay, what is it that these pills are actually doing? What neurotransmitters are they affecting? And that is where a lot of the narrative actually starts, with trying to like introduce this idea of a chemical imbalance. A lot of these discoveries were like 50s, right? 1965 was the first chemical imbalance theory that was officially published in scientific literature. That was saying, look, these pills are affecting the monoamines. They're affecting noradrenaline, which is the big one, norepinephrine. Later, it was found that it was also dopamine. But then we didn't really pay attention to it much at first, but they were also affecting serotonin. So there was these three neurotransmitters that these drugs had an effect on, that they were producing more of in the brain. And there were also studies that showed that when we depleted animals of those neurotransmitters, that we were able to produce the depressive symptoms. And so there was this dichotomy where it's like, if we reduce all of those neurotransmitters in an animal's brain, they look depressed. But then if we treat them with these medications, those depressive symptoms go away. So it has to be that those neurotransmitters are the cause of depression. And that then kind of started the narrative that then led into the 70s and 80s when serotonin reuptake inhibitors were created in 1987.
And it's such an interesting story, because when you hear that logic at first, it sounds valid. But the thing is, I love this. There's this comparison that's often made in this when we're talking about this hypothesis. And it's like, so, okay, you observe that there, when you increase the level of these neurotransmitters, it changes mood. It maybe makes people feel better. And if you deplete it, it makes them feel worse. But like, if you compare that to something like a headache, right? If you give somebody Advil and it cures their headache, you don't then conclude that the cause of headaches is a lack of Advil in the brain or something like that. And of course it's more sophisticated than that, but I think it, just to see that sort of poke some holes in that logic that are going to be really important for us discussing this theory. And I think actually an important thing to think about with the serotonin hypothesis of depression specifically was that we start narrative started shifting toward, okay, it's not a lack of dopamine and norepinephrine and serotonin. It seems to be just a lack of serotonin that's causing depression. And yeah. Maybe I'm skipping ahead a little bit, but it's interesting to me because the studies that have been done on animals that have had the gene basically for serotonin deleted in their brains or have had it depleted, they actually don't show the classic symptoms that we associate with depression for rodents, yeah, especially. And that's like hard to kind of map onto humans, right? You can't ask a mouse, yeah, how it feels. But it's just another one of these points where there maybe wasn't as careful of science as there should have been when we're talking about coming up with this grand unified theory of depression and being, oh, it's a low level of serotonin in the brain, when the reality is there wasn't a great deal of reason to believe in the first place that that was what was going on. So I know I'm skipping ahead a little bit through the story. But yeah.
No, I think that's perfect because one of the things that's really important to highlight through all of this, right, is that I mentioned that SSRIs were created in 1987. Right, that was when the first one was like FDA approved. This Prozac, fluoxetine, right? And MRI, brain imaging, did not become prevalent until the late 1990s, right? We didn't really have a way to even image someone's brain. We didn't have a way to check whether or not these neurotransmitters were low in people when we were making these conclusions, right? It was what's called in scientific circles, it was a reverse inference. It was saying that we see that this thing did something, right? That this drug, it produced more serotonin. And so now we're inferring that serotonin is the cause, right? And one of the things that's really interesting of the shift from these other neurotransmitters to serotonin specifically is that the early antidepressants, they mainly had an effect on norepinephrine. That was like a huge focus early on. And a lot of the debate was like depression's low norepinephrine. Nobody today really like thinks about that, right? That's not like a narrative, right? And when SSRIs were created, there was actually a lot of debate that happened, that it was like, it's serotonin. No, it's norepinephrine. No, it's all three, whatever. But what I think is really important to think about is that these drugs that hit the market needed to be kind of pitched to a patient in a certain way. Right. And I think that's really what we want to kind of dig into today is the idea of why this narrative was used in the first place and what it can potentially do to patients. Right. You go in to see a prescriber and you look at the 1990s. There's this prevalent idea that these antidepressants, and it's interesting to think about the word antidepressant. Right. Because early on, they were called psychic energizers. Like that's what they were first labeled as. And there was actually like a marketing pitch that was like, no, we need to call these something that are like anti the disease state that they're going after, right? But antidepressants don't remove depression. They're not antidepressive, right? They have certain cognitive effects that we'll talk about, right? That are helpful in certain respects in terms of dealing with depression. And that's why they bring relief to certain people that actually do find relief from them. But they don't make depression go away, right? But this was part of the story, right? That the reason they're called antidepressants and the reason why this kind of narrative was so like provocative, it was so like useful, was that you have someone come into a prescriber's office that usually sees the psychiatrist, whatever it is, for 15 minutes, 30 minutes max. And that prescriber has to pitch to that person how this medication is going to benefit them, right? And there was studies coming out showing that these things were beneficial, that they were helping a lot of people, that they were reducing suicide rates, like all of this kind of stuff. They were helping people kind of develop this new sense of who they were, all of this stuff. But the really easy way to pitch these things is that your brain is lacking something. Your brain is broken. It does not have enough serotonin. And just like someone with diabetes needs to take insulin, you need to take serotonin. And that is going to fix your depression. These things are antidepressive, right? I started this whole episode saying that if you go and ask people on the street, 85, this is like real studies have done this, 85% of the average people in the world believe that depression is caused by something wrong in their brain, right? And that's what we really want to get into is looking at whether or not, like, this is where the narrative came from, right? That's kind of why we painted this history in the first place, of saying, like, this is why the chemical imbalance theory exists. And there was a lot of medication that went out under this headline, right? And there's still a lot of people that believe that they're fixing their chemical imbalance. But now I think we're going to get into kind of what that means and what kind of support there is. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think it's so tempting when you're really suffering like that to want a drug that is going to correct the problem that's causing your suffering. And so and I think that's something that we're going to touch on a lot, is that a lot of the effect that antidepressants have, the positive effect on depression, is due to a kind of placebo effect, a kind of hope that this is going to work, that this is going to solve this problem. And I think that is super important. And I just want to back up a second, because we've been throwing around a lot of terms that I think most people are probably familiar with, but just to kind of set the stage, you know, serotonin is this neurotransmitter, right? It's a technically often referred to as a neuromodulator, but basically, you know, it is released from neurons and it affects the firing rate of other neurons, right? And it's manufactured in specific places in the brain, and it is kind of sprayed out to other areas of the brain, so to speak. But SSRIs, what that stands for is selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors. And what that means is these are drugs that block the reuptake of serotonin. So that just means that they're stopping serotonin from being kind of sucked back into the cells that it was released from. So there is effectively more serotonin in the extrasynaptic space, in the space around neurons, basically. So it's effectively increasing the available serotonin in the brain. I just wanted to get that out there, because we've thrown it around a lot. And that's why it was thought that these drugs would address the, you know, so to speak, underlying core problem of depression, namely low serotonin. So that I just want to throw that out there. Like, it's a very clean narrative when you look at it from that angle. And again, it gives people a lot of hope, because it's very easy to understand, what are these drugs doing? Oh, they're addressing the cause of this problem. And that will, you know, lift your mood and allow you to feel better. And my point about hope and the sort of placebo effect is that when you tell somebody that something is going to make them better, we know that already has an effect on a certain number of people in the population, or it can make them feel better just from thinking that it's going to make you feel better. That's why we have the gold standard in drug research is the placebo-controlled trial, because we know that there is such a thing as a placebo effect. And so I just want to get that out there. Of course, there have been placebo-controlled trials of serotonin. And one of the things we'll get into is that, SSRIs. And one of the things we'll get into is that it seems from at least some studies that they're not doing much more than a placebo. So that the effect of the SSRI isn't that much more than a placebo. And there are some researchers that argue that it's not any better than a placebo. But yeah, anyway, that's
you know, and I think we can maybe even get into that part right now. We're going to discuss, there's a really kind of, landmark paper. I think that I heard this morning, actually, that it's in the top 320 of 21 million papers in terms of how much it's been shared and read. So very influential, this paper that calls these chemical imbalance things into question. But it's also very kind of divisive. There's a lot of critics of the paper itself that we'll talk about as well. But one of the things that I think we can maybe just jump into right now is what Andrew was just talking about, is that there's a lot of researchers that think that the antidepressants are not much better than placebo. And that actually comes from these randomized double-blind clinical trials that they do with these drugs. And one of the depression scales that's the most widely used in these studies is the Hamilton Depression Scale. It's a self-report scale where you report your symptoms of depression, and it's got 52 points, right? And when you look at the reduction in depression symptoms for the group of people that had SSRIs, on average, they have a reduction of about 8 to 10 points on this scale in terms of depression symptoms from taking the SSRIs, which is very helpful in terms of, like, I mean, that's a fifth of the scale that you're coming down in terms of depressive symptoms. But placebos also have a 6 to 8 point reduction. So when you really look at it, it's only about 2 point difference between SSRIs and placebos, which is not a lot. We are going to get into, though, it's not just placebo, right? There is definitely a lot going on, I think, with the placebo idea. And Andrew made a really good point that telling someone that there's something wrong with their brain and telling them that there is a form of relief does give them a lot of hope, right? It's like, and we want to be very, like, open about the fact that depression is awful, right? Like, these people want relief. They can't get out of bed. They can't interact with their loved ones. It's really hard on families and on the person themselves, right? And so having this option for relief does give them, like Andrew said, a lot of hope that can produce these placebo effects. But one of the things that we're going to look at too is that it also is having an effect on the serotonin system. And so we're going to look, kind of after we get into some of this debate about the chemical imbalance, about what serotonin is actually doing and how these drugs might be having some kind of an effect that's not just the placebo effect, right? And so maybe let's get into this kind of big umbrella review. Do you want to kind of maybe say what an umbrella review actually is?
Right. So an umbrella review is basically a review of other reviews and meta-analyses. And a review is a, I'm going to use the word review like 1,000 times in the next sentence, but it's a review of studies, right? So like a straight up literature review is when you are looking at all the studies or a large number of the studies on a given topic. Yeah. And then a meta-analysis is typically a little bit more quantitative than just like a literature review. And so what they're doing is they're kind of trying to quantify all the results from all those studies, put it together into a meta-analysis, an analysis of analyses. But an umbrella review is like the most meta level because it's a review of reviews and meta-analyses put together. So it's trying to put all the literature together and combine it and then answer some specific question.
Yeah. And what they were essentially trying to find out is, you know, this narrative has been really pervasive. It's been used to push a lot of medication, right? Where is the state of the scientific evidence in terms of depression being a result of low serotonin? And one of the things that I think is really important to mention is that studying serotonin levels in the brain is actually really hard. It's an incredibly small molecule, and so we have to study it in very indirect ways. And so there was a whole host of different ways that other studies have looked at serotonin levels. One of the ways is looking at serotonin in the blood, which is kind of interesting because, like, 95% of the serotonin is actually in the body. But serotonin cannot cross the blood-brain barrier. So there's like a serotonin system in our body that controls like digestion and nutrient intake and all of these kind of things. But then there's a completely separate serotonin system in the brain. And so one of the methods was studying like serotonin levels in the blood, but that doesn't really get at serotonin levels in the brain. They were also looking at the level of serotonin receptors, which you can do with certain neuroimaging techniques and other, you can look at cerebrospinal fluid for some of these things with, the other thing is serotonin transporter levels. So this is the thing that brings the serotonin back up into the neuron, kind of recycles the serotonin. And so all of these things, like the amount of receptors, will determine how much of an effect serotonin has in the brain. The recycler will probably tell you how much serotonin is left in kind of the space between the neurons, right? So all of these different ways of kind of getting at it. And there was another one that looked at what are called tryptophan depletion studies. So serotonin itself is created from the precursor tryptophan. You've probably heard of like getting really sleepy after like a Thanksgiving dinner. Turkey is really high in tryptophan. All right. Serotonin has a lot to do with like modulating our sleep and things like that. But what they are able to do is give you this mixture that essentially depletes the availability of tryptophan. And if the brain doesn't have tryptophan, then it can't create serotonin. And so it starts depleting serotonin. And so then they're looking and seeing, okay, in humans, if we deplete serotonin, does that produce depressive-like symptoms? Right. And then the last couple of categories they looked at were genes that have been identified as being linked to depression and whether those genes are linked to adverse events in someone's life. And what they came to conclusion was that none of these sources of evidence were strong enough to clearly say that serotonin is low in people that are depressed. They actually found in depressed people that serotonin levels were actually higher in some instances, but they weren't sure whether or not that was because a lot of these people that were depressed in these studies were taking antidepressants. But it was published in Molecular Psychiatry, which is a very prestigious psychiatry journal. And so this made a lot of waves. And it was, I think, received by a lot of psychiatrists with an expectation. I think there were a lot of people in the field that kind of knew that the evidence wasn't very strong, but they also produced a lot of critics in terms of people saying that this review was done unethically and biased and all of these kind of things. So we'll kind of get into that too.
Yeah. And I guess just to put it out there, it is a different question. There's two different questions. Is serotonin low in depression, which is really, to be honest, like when you, I mean, in hindsight, at least, it's a very simplistic question. It's, I mean, yeah. You know, we'll get into that. And I think I've expressed on my channel before that, like, it just couldn't possibly be true. I mean, it could possibly be true, but it's very unlikely to be true given what we know about psychiatric disease and the brain in general. That's one question. Is serotonin low in depression? And then the other question is, do SSRIs treat depression? Right. And mm-hmm. so that those can, we could actually separate those questions, but, and that review actually did look at kind of both of those questions. Yep. But yeah, to some of the criticisms of it were things like they actually, in some cases, disagreed with the conclusions of many of the papers that they were reviewing. So some of the meta-analyses that they actually looked at concluded that there was an effect of low serotonin or of SSRIs treating depression. And they kind of, in their own, using their own methods, decided, oh, that conclusion wasn't valid. It gets a little bit complicated on the way that they were analyzing these studies versus how the original authors were. But there's that to take account of. It wasn't that every single study that they looked at found no effect or completely agreed with their conclusion. It was that using their analysis methods, they found that there was no evidence that serotonin is low in depression.
Yeah, and there were some critics that said that, you know, they only included studies up to 2020. And a lot of the critics have said, you know, there's new neuroimaging techniques that are showing low kind of receptor levels for serotonin in people that are depressed that weren't included in the review. A lot of the flack was actually around these tryptophan depletion studies because they came to the conclusion that depleting tryptophan, lowering serotonin in someone was not reliably creating depressive symptoms. But when you look back at the papers, there was actually pretty big effect sizes in terms of production of depression symptoms with tryptophan depletion. But I think one of the critiques that is a little bit hard to get around that I've come across is that the authors of the paper are known to be very critical of psychiatry in general, which is something to consider when you're doing this massive review and you're making conclusions about all of these things, and you have some kind of bias going in because they've written a ton of articles about that have been very kind of critical of antidepressant use in general. You have Joanna Moncrief and you have Mark Horowitz. Mark Horowitz is like known to be the person that talks about how to successfully get off of antidepressants, right? And so that is something to consider. But it's tricky when you get into these waters, because something that I kind of grapple with is the idea of causation. And that's, I think, where we want to go with some of this, especially as we start looking at serotonin, is whether or not this narrative is useful, right? Of trying to tell people that we're fixing something that's wrong, right? Is it that low serotonin is causing depression? There could be low serotonin in depressed people, but it could be because their brain is adapting to really stressful life circumstances. And that could just be a strategy that their brain is using. Not that the brain is broken, that it's maladaptive, that there's some gene that's doing something wrong in their brain. But there was a study that they did where they did this longitudinal study, and they gave people these depressive questionnaires like every couple of years. And they went all the way up to age 40. And they found that by age 40, 86% of the people had met criteria for depression at some point in their life, right? 86% of the people running the study were like, that other 14% were probably lying, right? And it's to highlight the fact that like depression is something that's really common. It's something that we experience when we go through really adverse, stressful life events. And so I think what we're wanting to kind of pivot towards is we have this idea where there's this big landmark review saying, you know, it's not a chemical imbalance. There's some critiques of it. We want to kind of step out a little bit and say, let's think about depression in a more holistic way and not try to say that it's the result of this one little thing, right? And that pill is fixing that thing and making the depression go away, because that pill is not making abusive partners go away. It's not making poverty go away. It's not making a terrible boss go away, right? These things have incredibly high correlation rates with depression, right? And so really, as we kind of move in, we're going to talk about serotonin, what serotonin does, why these drugs might have an effect in the first place. But we wanted to kind of set the stage for the idea that this narrative might not be the useful narrative to use. Even if there is low serotonin in people that are depressed, is it really right to be kind of pushing this medication based on the idea that it might be fixing an imbalance?
Yeah. And like one finding that I think is important to talk about is whenever we talk, especially about psychiatric medicine, it's really rare that the drug alone is the most effective solution. Usually what's found is drug plus therapy, often cognitive behavioral therapy, especially when we're talking about depression, is the most effective thing, right? Or it's more effective than either treatment alone often. And that was something we talked about in our last episode about psychedelics, is like there's this kind of revolution, scientific revolution around psychedelics going on that looks at, oh, look at how effective these new medications or these new molecules are for treating depression or anxiety or, you know, chronic pain or whatever it might be. It's usually not that psilocybin or LSD, or in this case, SSRIs, are actually changing the brain so that it is not depressed. It's that the way I look at it is it is making the brain more conducive to the kinds of psychological changes that have to happen for someone to emerge from depression or to be better able to deal with the stressors of life or to reframe their life and change things. And just sometimes it's just taking the pressure off so that they can have that room to think and feel and change their psychology. And I think that's the theme that I want to really highlight here, is like, I think it's just, this is a principle of, I don't want to say of psychiatry, but of human change, of our ability to change ourselves, is that it starts with our psychology. That's the proper level to really be looking at this at, is our behavior, our thoughts, our emotions. It's that level that is really the change maker. And of course, the brain in my view, and I think both our view, is what is producing that. The brain, the body, the biology is what's behind all that. But talking about, oh, we're going to fix your brain and then therefore you're going to not be depressed anymore. Maybe that works in like 1% of cases or something like that. But it's more often than not, it is these life circumstances that Taylor's talking about. And I think most importantly, for empowering people, it's about how you respond to those life circumstances.
I think there's some really good stuff in what you just said. One of the things that I really wanted to highlight in this episode was the idea that this narrative of chemical imbalance, of a broken brain, I think very much undercuts the resiliency of the human mind. They've even shown in studies that people that believe that there's something wrong with their brain have a harder time overcoming these things in the future, because they think that the only solution to fixing that chemical imbalance is the pill itself and is not the work that you're putting in to overcome that stress and overcome that adversity, right? Something that Andrew hinted at is that it is exactly true. When you look at success rates in terms of remission of depression, it's usually in conjunction with therapy, that these meds are doing something, but there's also the hard work that goes in kind of restructuring the way that you deal with the world, right? And something that I really appreciate about medication in general is that it allows a lot of people a chance to come to the table, which I think is huge, right? If you can't even get out of bed in the morning, and an antidepressant is going to help you do that and help you get to the therapy office to then start doing the cognitive behavioral work, the expressive work, the artwork, whatever it might be, like, that's really important. And we don't want to undercut the idea that medications can be useful. Like, this is not, like I said at the beginning, an indictment on antidepressants. We don't want to say that, like, antidepressants bad. What we want to get at is whether or not the narrative is useful. And, like, I don't see it as being useful. I see it as really kind of taking a lot of the societal environmental factors of depression out of the equation, and also taking out the ability of someone to do the hard work to get through those things.
Yeah, that's such a good point. And then you say it's not useful, and I agree with that. And as we've been talking about, it's probably not even really true. Like, this is one of the things that I want to also highlight is something I mentioned, I think, in our episode on ADHD, and I've talked about before, that, like, my understanding of psychiatric disorders in general is that there is a spectrum for pretty much everything, and there are subtypes of pretty much everything. And to then just go, oh, well, okay, depression is a lack of neurotransmitter A, or the serotonin, or dopamine, norepinephrine, or it's this or that. It's like, no, this is not the proper way to even look at this category of, you know, human suffering in the first place. Like, we have to think about the fact that this is kind of a spectrum. And, like, exactly as you mentioned, many people will go through depression as a normal part of life. Most of us probably will have something resembling a depression, even if we don't meet the DSM-5 criteria for depression, which, in all honesty, like, when you look at all the symptoms and everything, there's a bit of arbitrariness to the way that we classify these illnesses or these disorders in the first place. So anyway, I feel like I'm on my soapbox about these.
No, and I just have one more thing to say there. Something really resonated me in some of the research that we did. There was something, think what you want about Joanna Moncrief, but she's the one that was, like, the main author on this Umbrella Review. She made a really good point in terms of, why is it that we're using a disease model for pushing these medications, that these medications are antidepressive, right? That they are fixing the disease, right? Instead, what she argues for is a medication-based model of saying, this is what this medication does, and let's talk about what it does, and then give people the informed consent to decide whether or not to take that. Because I think informed consent right here is a huge thing to consider, right? If I'm being told that it is fixing something wrong with my brain, then I'm not being informed correctly to make the proper decision about whether I'm going to be on this medication for the next 10 years of my life. But if instead I'm told this medication has cognitive effects that result in emotional blunting of not just blunting negative stuff, but also blunting positive stuff, blunting sexual libido and all of these things, that can be really helpful for depression, especially if there's a lot of negative emotion that you need blunted, right? But that's a very different story than telling me that my brain is broken.
Yeah, that's a good, real, that's a perfect way of saying it. And I think when we talk about serotonin in general, I think it is just from the outset, in my opinion, it is kind of crazy to say that serotonin, like to even, honestly, to even think that serotonin would be the cause of depression, like low serotonin would cause depression, only because serotonin is involved in so many different things in the brain and the body. And as Taylor mentioned, there's these two separate systems. There's this gut-based serotonin system, basically. And you'll hear people say, well, 95% of the serotonin in your body is produced in your gut. And therefore, your gut is important for depression and things like that. And I'm not saying the gut isn't important for depression, yeah, but that line of reasoning is bad because, as Taylor mentioned earlier, there is the inability of serotonin to cross the blood-brain barrier. So the idea, the current science is that basically all of the serotonin that's in your brain is produced in your brain. And what it does is an enormous number of things. And to put some context to this, there's 13 known subtypes of receptors for serotonin. And we talked about a couple of them in the last episode, the 1A receptor, the 2A receptor. These are the most common, but there's a whole world of serotonin research that is just trying to figure out what is going on. What is this one subtype of receptor doing? What kinds of neural circuits is it involved with? And most of the time, what it's doing has nothing to do with mood and emotion. I mean, sometimes it does. I'm not saying that it has nothing to do with depression, but I just want people to understand like how complex this system is, just the serotonin system. Yeah. And I'm like showing my cards here, but I just think that the serotonin hypothesis of depression was probably never really plausible. You know, maybe there was some, I'm not as smart as the researchers who came up with it in the first place. So there's a lot that I don't know, but I'm just saying that, you know, from my understanding of what serotonin is, what it does, it seems very difficult to like square that picture with the idea that that's what's wrong with the brain in depression. Anyway.
So, I mean, let's look real quick. Like why might antidepressants be having positive effects for some people that are depressed? And something that Andrew just hinted at is there's two main receptor types that are the most common in the brain, and that's 2A and 1A. We talked a lot about 2A in the last episode with psychedelics. Those are mainly in the cortex, and those are mainly excitatory. Those kind of open things up and get things like firing and talking to each other. The 1A system is subcortical. It's in the regions of the brain that are in the middle, that are kind of more ancient, I guess you could say. But they're the regions of the brain that are involved with drive and motivation, with emotion, with all of the kind of like feeling states that come with being alive. And the 1A system is actually inhibitory. It's not excitatory. And so one of the things that you see that's really anecdotal with people that are taking antidepressants is this idea of emotional blunting, that when you take an antidepressant, it makes you kind of numb to a lot of the emotional experiences, a lot of the drive that you might have, motivation that you might have. It like cuts your sexual libido in a lot of cases, right? But it's not just negative emotion that's being blunted. It's kind of a whole spectrum of emotion that's being blunted. And there are researchers that think that like this is why antidepressants might have the small amount of efficacy that they have, is because if you have someone that is experiencing severe amount of suffering, and then you're able to kind of tamp down and blunt and kind of make them a little bit numb to a lot of that stuff, that can actually be really helpful. It can help them get up. It can help them engage, right? But then that's a very different story. And that's something, it's a different approach to using these medications, right? Because if I was told that this is going to help me blunt the negative affect so that I can come to the table and put the hard work in, I'm going to have a very different opinion about how long I'm on that medication than if it's fixing something in my brain.
That's such a good point. It's so the opposite of the way that we talked about psychedelics in the last episode, that the whole approach with psychedelic psychotherapy is you do this maybe a few times. You take this super powerful psychedelic drug maybe a few times in the context of undergoing therapy and with a lot of preparation going up to it. And it's like, okay, it's opening this window of plasticity where you can change your thoughts and your emotions and your just conception of life and yourself in that. And it's just so the opposite of how antidepressants are often pitched to people, marketed, that it's like, you're going to take this thing every day and it's going to like fix the underlying problem without any work on your part. And that's a simplification. I know that a lot, yeah, like probably most people, I don't know about most, but many people who are prescribed these medications know that they are also expected to be doing psychological work, or that could be helpful. But it is just like, I think if not, like Taylor's mentioning, if that's not kind of part of your treatment regime, that's something to think really seriously about, that it's probably not that the drug itself is going to fix this problem, because the problem is not low serotonin. It's it comes back to that.
And I think there's something really important to highlight here, right? Some people might be hearing this for the first time, and you might have been kind of believing this narrative for a long time, just like 85% of the other people out there, right? This can be kind of shocking for someone that may not like their medication. But what we want to very much kind of discourage is just cold turkey coming off of these medications, because there's a really important distinction I want to make between addiction and physical dependency, right? They're often kind of used interchangeably, but they can be very different, right? Addiction is usually associated with things that produce euphoric effects, right? I take alcohol because it feels good, right? And then I take it a lot and then I become dependent on it. We can become dependent on medications that don't produce any kind of euphoric effect. And that is absolutely the case with antidepressants. And coming off of antidepressants, I was listening to Mark Horowitz talk about this, and like a quarter of the people that come off antidepressants have severe withdrawal symptoms. And most of the textbooks and most of the psychiatrists, honestly, are under the kind of assumption that antidepressant withdrawal is mild and brief. And that is not the case anecdotally. I've seen the opposite of that for people that I've watched come off of these in my life. It's incredibly painful. And something that's really kind of insidious about this is that if you come off of an antidepressant and you start feeling intense anxiety to the point of like almost panic attacks, you start feeling low mood and fog and all of these things, a lot of the time people think that that's the underlying condition coming back. And a lot of the times, prescribers will say that's evidence that you need to go back on your antidepressant. What's not talked about a lot is that those are withdrawal symptoms, that your brain has been accustomed to being supplemented with serotonin. And so it has downregulated the amount of receptors. It stopped producing as much of its own serotonin, right? And so now when you come off of that drug, your brain is now in a lack of all of those things. And it takes a while for the brain to start coming back. Like there's a lot of reports of like these really uncomfortable, and I've seen people in my life experience them, these brain zaps, feels like electricity like running through your brain. There's like sweating, inability to sleep, and insomnia, like even worse anxiety than when you went on them in the first place. And so there's actually guidelines of how to safely taper these things back, and you should always do it very slowly.
Yeah, that's such a good point. And also I want to like back up, because someone like what I'm saying is like super critical of this, but like, I don't, again, like if somebody's on these medications listening to this, I don't want it to come off as like what you're doing is wrong, right? Yeah. Anything like that. I think it, my point is mostly that there's a lot, probably a lot of value in focusing more on your psychological work, on your mindset, on your behavior, on those kinds of things, you know, in addition to these medications, or, you know, as a substitute, as you as Taylor said, slowly taper off of them if that is the right thing for you to do. And we can't say whether that's right or not, right? And this, so that's like one point I just want to make there, because yeah, this is like drugs in general are really difficult to come off of, even when they're not like classically, you know, super addictive drugs. And I'll just share like a personal anecdote here that has, it's not about antidepressants, but you know, I like, especially when I was a teenager, I was just like a total pothead. I would smoke weed like throughout the day, the morning, you know, at whenever I had a chance, really. And of course, like marijuana is not a very addictive drug. But you know, I did that for years, for like 16 years, basically. Not 16, let's call it 10. And then after that, I was still a daily user. I was like a heavy, very heavy user of marijuana for like a long time. And it's only recently that I decided, okay, I don't want that to be part of my life anymore. And so I consciously, like knowing about the effects that drugs can have when you come off of them, I knew that I had to do this gradually, and I had to do it like very carefully and very exactly, because I know that for myself, like I had become, you know, at least emotionally dependent. I don't know, physically dependent. I don't know if that's really like possible with marijuana. I think it probably is. But anyway, the point I'm getting at is like to do any of this stuff, it takes, first of all, you have to have a like a psychological disposition around this of why you're doing it and why it's really important for you and whether it's the right step for you at this point in your life, and make a lot of preparation for that, and then gradually come off of it. And when it comes to prescription medications, it might be harder because you might have to have the right dose to come down to, and that might not be immediately available to you. But I'm just saying, like, I understand coming off of a drug that you've been on for a really long time and been depending on emotionally can be a really challenging experience, and it can be emotionally challenging. It can also be physically challenging, and to do it right, I think, is really important, and to give yourself that time and grace. And, anyway, yeah, just kind of a personal aside there, but you know.
No, I think that's really important, because I think that a lot of the prescribers honestly have not experienced withdrawal. And so a lot of them don't understand how bad these things can be. And there's just kind of this textbook answer of like, keep having your pills until you're done or whatever. But there's actually some really interesting research. There's new guidelines in the UK that the US has not adopted. Most prescribers in the US say, keep having your pills, but low doses of pills have a greater effect than high doses. The dose kind of plateaus. And so when you get to low doses, you don't want to just keep having. You want to go just like a little tiny bit at a time, because that last little bit is usually the hardest, because those small amounts have the biggest effects. But again, I think something that is really important to maybe get back to is why this kind of push has happened, right? Because I think that something that Andrew has been hinting a lot at is a lot of the work that goes in, the psychological work that goes in. That stuff is hard, right? That stuff takes a lot of time. It takes a lot of energy. And when you're meeting with a professional about these kind of things, it takes time to get into, right? Think about your time spent with a therapist versus your time spent with a prescriber, right? Like, you may see a therapist once a week, once every 2 weeks. You see a prescriber once every couple of months, and you see them for half, if not a quarter of the amount of time that you see a therapist for, right? And so, like, I don't want to just, like, bag on psychiatrists, because they have a really difficult job to do. They have to, like, kind of get all of this stuff done in 15 minutes and try to provide the most relief that they can for you. And in these situations, a lot of the time, the kind of relief that they can provide is in the form of a pill. That does provide some immediate relief. I mean, if you look at the studies, 66% of people, after they've tried all of the medications that were available, have found some kind of relief from an antidepressant, right? But in those short kind of meetings that you have with the prescriber, mm-hmm. they don't have time to get into your trauma. They don't have time to get into your relationships, to get into the way that poverty or the way that your job might be affecting your mood, right? that's the kind of work that you got to put in on your own. That's the kind of work that you have to set time aside to maybe work through with a second party, with a therapist, whatever it may be. And these medications can help you do that. But that's a really important kind of distinction that I want to make between like general practitioner, psychiatrist, and therapist, is that it's very different work, right? And it's a very different amount of time that goes into diagnosis, right? Like a prescriber might diagnose you with depression, only meeting you for 30 minutes to an hour, right? Off of a couple of self-report questionnaires and not a lot of information about your life. But you go to a therapist and you see them once a week for 2 months, they have a much more like all-encompassing view of your circumstances, of your temperament, your personality, all of those kind of things, right? And so think about those things when you're thinking about a label that's been given to you by a prescriber, right?
Yeah, that's a really good point. We're not trying to trash on physicians or psychiatrists or anything, because it's a really hard job. And sometimes it, you know, there is also the argument of sometimes people don't have the time and space to put into the kind of psychological work that we're talking about.
Yep.
And maybe there are cases where just that emotional blunting that's provided by SSRIs, maybe that is a good solution for some people in certain situations. But I guess we're talking about ideally what can you do to really, I don't know, to optimize your mental health, so to speak, to get through these things.
So I want to just kind of empathize with everyone out there that is suffering. I know this is a really kind of hard topic for a lot of people. Like the things that contribute to your level of suffering are very personal. They're very intense. Like they're things that we want to honor and recognize. And our whole point of doing this episode was really to kind of give you insight into your own process, right? Into what it is that might be contributing to it. Right? To really kind of take in all of the environmental factors, all of the social factors, the psychological factors, your temperament, your personality, and also the biology, right? Understanding how the brain works, what these things might be doing, because it's really through a holistic kind of perspective like that you can start to get a handle on some of these things. And there's never going to be this just like easy fix to something as incredibly complex as depression actually is.
Really true. Really important to say. And I think I've been harping on this point of the psychology and the maybe the environmental inputs into all this. But there's also like there just is the fact that your physiology really does matter, that your general health matters. So when it comes to like things like exercise and literally like nutrition and just like really basic health stuff, sleep. Yeah, exactly. These things are going to be really important for your mental health. Like, we've talked about it in the past, but it's something that's just often overlooked in these conversations. And I don't want that to be the case here because, you know, to be honest, like for me, the most powerful, most important parts of maintaining my mental health, and whether it's, just staving off anxiety or symptoms of depression or whatever it may be, is exercise, good sleep, good nutrition, and then these mindset and psychological things as well. So like, I don't want to just forget about that because your physiology does matter. We're not saying like your brain and your biology doesn't matter at all. It's just that it's part of, as Taylor said perfectly, it's this holistic picture of everything put together.
So I think that is what we got for all of you today. We very much appreciate everyone continuing to tune in. We love doing these episodes. This has been really kind of interesting for us to dig into and research and to know more about. So if there are any topics that you as the audience want us to dig into, like feel free to leave us comments. Check out our Patreon page if you want to support us. But we very much appreciate the support.
Yeah, and if you want to learn more about treatments for depression or just the serotonin system or some of the things we mentioned around psychedelics today, check out our last episode on psychedelics. It is that was probably, I think, one of the most fascinating episodes for me that we've done in a really long time. So check that out.
And we will be doing a follow-up to these two episodes in a Patreon-only episode that looks at kind of the serotonin system altogether, about psychedelics and antidepressants and these approaches to kind of looking at how to treat depression. So we'll see you for that one.